It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Sometimes when you are inundated by the present, it helps to know that the past is prologue. Presidential historian John Meacham sees a lot of parallels between the United States in 2018 and the U.S. of about a century ago and even further. Meacham is the author of the book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. John Meacham, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
We are taking calls for John Meacham today, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So your title of the book, John, is The Soul of America, the Battle for Our Better Angels. What is America's soul?
Well, soul in Hebrew and in Greek means life or breath. It was a key part of pagan philosophy. Socrates in the Phaedo asked, what makes a person a person? And he answers his own question saying, a soul. So what I was trying to get at was, what was the essential character, not only of a person, but of a nation? Since a republic is, in fact, the sum of its parts, we are all responsible for the state of the whole as we move through our lives. And in my view, the soul of the country has the capacity for Dr. King, and it has the capacity for the Ku Klux Klan.
Hmm.
And if you look historically, not ideologically, not politically, but just as a clinical historical matter, every era is defined by that struggle. And I believe that we have always become stronger and better, if you will, the more generously we've interpreted the Jeffersonian assertion of human equality.
So you believe that the Klan is pulling us in the wrong direction, but it keeps popping up?
I believe it's as much a part of the country as our better angels. And I think it's one of the things that drives me crazy, I'm sure you deal with this every day, is people say if something's going on in the country that they don't like, and there may be one or two of your listeners who are in that position. I don't know, maybe. then they think that the country has somehow been taken over. My argument is not so fast. That lets us off the hook. The country is a flawed and fallen entity. And what we have to do, and what the framers recognized in forming the Constitution, was we had to recognize our sinfulness. We had to recognize that we're driven by appetite and ambition and do all we can to overcome that. And so the idea that somehow or another the dark side of the American experience is not who we are is, I think, it kind of creates a kind of anesthetization, and it doesn't enable us to confront those forces in real time.
So you are drawing a parallel when you say better angels between essentially angels and devils, the light side and the dark side. There are a lot of people out there who are going to say that the people that you're putting forward as angels are actually emblematic of liberalism.
Well, I am a classical liberal in the sense that liberalism in the 19th century, when it became a dominant political philosophy, was about liberty. It was about freedom. 19th century liberals and 20th century conservatives at their heart have a great deal in common. I'm not really, you know, given the fact that left and right in American politics move every generation or so.
Indeed.
You know, the parties change fundamentally. You know, I think it's more useful to think about what characteristics, that is, what disposition of heart and mind in a given era makes that an era that is both, that's one that we both want to emulate and commemorate. Because we spend a lot of time looking back, right? We spend a lot of time saying, if only we could have Ronald Reagan again or FDR again or whatever. But you have to think, all right, what was it about that era? And I promise you, and we can run through them as long as you want, that at every point when we pull out an era that is worth going back to by common consent, it will be marked by a more generous understanding of fair play and of open arms and of open the free flow of ideas and of people and of goods.
You write that extremism, racism, nativism, and isolationism, driven by fear of the unknown, tend to spike in periods of economic and social stress, a period like the one we are in now. Give us what points in history look most similar to our current social and political climate.
I think right now the best example is the 19-teens and 20s, where you had a fundamental economic shift unfolding between an agrarian world and an industrial world.
Mm.
You had a lot of immigration. You had a lot of fears on the part of the white working class that immigrants were going to come and take jobs. You had the First World War, which created this sense that there was a global elite that was profiting off the fighting of others, the idea of arms merchants, the idea of conspiracy. You had the introduction of the radio, which suddenly created a national and therefore foreign, as in outside your own household, culture. Imagine if you were a householder for the entire life of humanity, for all of known history, you controlled the culture that affected your family because it was your neighborhood, it was your church, it was your business, presumably your neighbors. But then suddenly you buy this box, and there are these people in Hollywood and New York, these faraway places, who are coming in and telling you what to think. It created an enormous sense of distrust of the outside world. And the greatest manifestation of this happened at Stone Mountain, Georgia, in 1915, in the fall, when the Ku Klux Klan was refounded. It had been a postbellum terroristic organization in my native region in the South. It had been largely put down by U.S. Grant as president in 1870-71, but it was recreated, attracted 3 to 5 million members, not just in the South. There were members in all 48 states at the time, Indiana, Colorado, Oregon, Texas, Georgia, New York, all had extraordinary Klan presence in their politics. The 1924 Democratic National Convention had 347 Klan members as delegates. It took 103 ballots to nominate a president because the Klan refused to support Al Smith, the Irish Catholic governor of New York, because the Klan was fundamentally anti-Roman Catholic, because many immigrants were Roman Catholic. And so you had this period of enormous ferment, of tumult, and a clear middle-class, lower-middle-class reaction that, guess what, wanted to make America great again.
Mm.
And what that meant was make America like it was before industrialization created a foreign economy and a need for foreign workers.
So I'm interested in what started us down the road we are now. We do have an economic shift. We are shifting to a more technological economy. Our social media, you mentioned the radio, has mm-hmm. changed the way we communicate with each other. And a lot of older people have had to relearn that. And we also had a terrorist attack on 9/11. Talk to me about how those have affected where we are now.
Well, I think it's Mark Twain once said history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. I think that's where we are. I think that all the ingredients for a classic populist reaction to the prevailing establishment politics of the world were in place in 2016. I dislike the cliche, a perfect storm, but boy, it applies here if it applies anywhere. You know, we had 10 presidential elections between 1980 and 2016. A Bush or a Clinton was on 80% of those tickets.
Mm-hmm.
Wages began to stagnate in a broad sense about 1987. Globalization really kicks in as NAFTA is first negotiated began under Reagan, was pushed under George H.W. Bush. Bill Clinton signed it. And we had this fight, remember, in 1992 with Ross Perot, who in some ways, Ross Perot and Pat Buchanan, both of whom were forces in 92, were in a way precursors. So they were an early kind of Pearl Harbor sign of Trumpism, because you have people who believed in because it was the world they knew. They believed in a large, the industrial might, which really, let's be honest, the huge manufacturing base of the United States, which holds such a remarkable place in our imaginations of our prosperity and our way of life, was a fairly brief period. It really began during World War II with the defense industries. It boomed during the Cold War. But, my God, when was the first piece about the decline of Detroit? And it must have been in the 60s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you had this brief period where, you know, we have this kind of Archie Bunker view where, you know, every man had a job and every woman was happy at home. And I think we all know that that's more myth than reality. Now, you don't get very far politically just telling people that their vision of a life they want is fantasy. So I'm not arguing that somehow or another this is a corrective. But I do think it helps us understand that the true challenge, it seems to me, of the era is, and every era does have one, slavery in the 19th century, industrialization under TR through the 20s, the Depression and the war in the middle of the century, the building of the great American middle class in that brief period, but remarkable period after the war. The great question of our time, as you just said a second ago, is globalization and its implications and this rapidly changing technology. And we haven't even really begun to understand how many jobs might disappear because of technology. I fear, and I use that word advisedly, I'm anxious that actually things may get worse before they get better in terms of people not finding their economic and cultural way.
We are talking about American history, how the country has overcome anger, intolerance, and extremism. John Meacham, his new book is called The Soul of America. We are also taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. We're going to be back with more with John Meacham in a moment. We are talking about American history and how the country has in the past overcome anger, intolerance, and extremism. John Meacham has written the book called The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. And as we took a break just now, John, you were saying, this is really depressing, you were saying that things are actually going to get worse, you think, before they get better.
I do. I think economically and culturally, there's an enormous amount of change that is coming that's even more profound than what we're facing now. And I think that it creates even more urgency, in my view, that we have to pass this stress test in citizenship. And my view is that in the past, when we've been in the McCarthy era, when we've been in an existential struggle over Jim Crow, over the really living under implicit and explicit apartheid, which was true 50 years ago. Women have not yet voted in this country for 100 years. I think this week marks only the third anniversary of the marriage equality decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, American history is at once ancient and entirely urgent and recent. You know, we get things, we tend to get things right, but it takes us a while. And it's always all these advances are always at risk. And we can't ever relax our vigilance. And my own view is that we can find a way forward through this great economic and cultural shift, but it's going to require investment in education. It's going to require smartly using the public sector to arm people to deal with an economy that is going to be radically different. And people who object to an involvement of the public sector in the creation of the infrastructure of a middle class are being ahistorical, because the great achievement of the post-war era, beginning in 1945 and really beginning with the war industries 1941 forward, was a combination of public investment and private enterprise. They were the two wings on which America took flight, if you will. And, you know, it goes back even farther than that. Land-grant universities, the railroads, the idea that the state has a role in helping to create the conditions for private prosperity is an ancient American idea. And I worry that without a historical understanding of that relationship, of that give and take, we end up with particularly stunted and unilluminating debates. So there's a great opening, it seems to me, for a political figure, a political movement that emphasizes growth, that don't talk about fiscal discipline, don't talk about inequality. Let's talk about growth. You know, America likes to look forward. You know, we're people who went across a continent when we didn't really have to. we climbed mountains when we didn't really need to.
Right.
There is something in the spirit of the country. That may sound sentimental to folks, but something can be sentimental and true at the same time. And my sense is that Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, Jack Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, these were presidents who, for all their faults, and we could spend the rest of the week talking about what they got wrong, but they did, in the end, want to point forward in hope instead of simply surviving politically on fear. And that's what I worry that we're involved in now with the president.
Okay, so let's go back, though.
The president enjoys the fight. He's not looking to advance.
Let's go back. Okay, let's go back. I'm gonna skip that one question that hit my head to 1915, where you say that this is a parallel 100 years ago, and we went through a stock market boom and bust. We went through a depression. We went through a world war. We didn't get to that golden age that you were talking about until we went through a world war. Is something like that on our horizon?
No, it's not, and it was not a goal. I mean, I pointed out the positive aspects to it, but I'm a white, Southern, boringly heterosexual man. Mm. It was a golden age for me.
Right.
It was not much of a golden age if you didn't look like me. It was not a golden age if you were African American. It was not a golden age if you were a woman. It was not a golden age if you were of a different sexual identity. So let's be clear that the politics of nostalgia are dangerous, and while they're alluring, they are also distorting, because they don't. And that's why my point in this book is not, hey, if only things could be like they were in 1950. Off. My point is, what if we work to where we have a president who, like Harry Truman, who came from a family of racist origin, really, who used racist epithets in private, but who became the first president who addressed the NAACP, who integrated the military, who commissioned the first major civil rights report, and who pointed forward to the work that would be done to finally finish the work of the Civil War under Lyndon Johnson. And what's alluring and what's really optimistic about that story, about that example, is nobody would have bet more than a dollar that Harry Truman would have done any of that on April 12, 1945, when he became president. He was a sectional senator. He was a compromise pick for vice president. Nobody knew a damn thing about him. GIs around the world said, well, who's president now? Because they were used to FDR. But when he became president, he saw his duty whole. And he was an imperfect man who did that. So the standard can't be, we've got to find Galahad. We simply need to, I think, take a deep breath when we choose our public officials. Remember that character is destiny, and do all we can to create in conversations like this, in whatever forms of civic and social activism there is, create a climate that it will not accept what so many of us, and I don't want to drag you into my view, but you know, it's just not, to me, it's not acceptable to have a president of the United States refer to the press as an enemy of the American people. Mm. And say that it's the biggest threat to our country.
Yeah, you wouldn't be dragging me anywhere on that one.
We
are talking to John Meacham, who wrote the book, The Soul of America. We are also taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. Anne from Green Bay is on the line, John. Anne, welcome to the program, and what is your comment or question?
Good morning. Well, I have to agree with him when he said that he feels things are going to get worse before they get better, because in this country right now we have a gun violence crisis, we have an incarceration crisis, we have an opioid crisis, the suicide rate is growing exponentially, and I think people are just feeling hopeless, and we have politicians who just seem to not want to address any of these, so I don't know where we're going to go, and it's really scary.
And thank you for that. And John, Anne has a really good point. And I have seen this, for the last probably 20, 25 years. There's just a hopelessness in the country. And that's kind of where our opioid crisis comes from. We have rising anxiety. People don't have jobs. You know, you may not think it was too much of a golden age, but at least people were brought up with the idea that things were going to be better. And for the last 20 years, that hasn't been the case.
Absolutely right. And that's why Donald Trump is president. Yeah. And one of the things we have to think about, though, and then I totally take the point, and you're exactly right about those social indicators as scary things. And again, I live in the South. We have, you know, when the country catches a cold, we get pneumonia.
yes.
So I'm fully aware of all of that. But here's an interesting thing. What is it about the country that can elect the first African-American president who ran on a platform called the Audacity of Hope in both majority elections and then in the next breath elect Donald Trump? So what is it about us that seems to bounce from guardrail to guardrail? I used to think that we would never see such a stark contrast as we saw between George W. Bush to Obama until Obama gave way to Trump, which means we may get Aristotle next time. I do think that we're in many ways there are deep underlying crises of faith in the country, and that's why. And instead of despairing, my view is, you know, we could have had the same, more or less, the same list of things in 1933.
Mm.
Men were committing suicide because they couldn't provide for their families. There were riots throughout the West over, you know, food shortages. One out of four Americans was out of work. There was a live question about whether or not democratic capitalism would survive the decade. On the night Franklin Roosevelt became president, an aide came to him and said, "Mr. President, if you succeed, you will go down as our greatest president. But if you fail, you will go down as our worst." And FDR looked at him and said, "If I fail, I'll go down as our last."
Mm.
So we were able in the 1930s to come through that. And it wasn't simply a magical act of Franklin Roosevelt's. You know, the New Deal was a complicated. There were two New Deals, in fact. It was a complicated, difficult time. There was conservative reaction. 40% of the country was never with FDR. They couldn't say his name. They called him that man. Remember the court packing scheme? That was to try to, to undo the conservative reaction to what he was doing. But when you really dig into art, so what got us through the 30s? There was a spirit of generosity. There was just enough. And that's what American history is about. That's what human history is about, I think, is just enough. There was just enough generosity of spirit. There was just enough, you know what, we can get through this, that we did. And I understand if people think this sounds like a 4th of July homily or something, but I promise I'm basing this as best I can on a clinical understanding of our history.
And do you think that there's just enough understanding now?
I do, if only because A, he didn't win the popular vote, which I think is a big indicator. I don't think I would have written this book if he had, because I think that would have signaled something even more profound. Again, I hate the cliche, but it was a weird set of circumstances that produced this. And I don't think. Let me turn it around and ask you, because you do this every day. Do you think we'd be having this conversation if Secretary Clinton had become president?
No. Well, maybe, because there was a lot of pushback on Obama. A lot of racism came out there, and I think a lot of people would have, they did set up Clinton as a straw man or a straw person, and they would have continued to do that. So we may be having this conversation.
Interesting. So my sense is it would have been a more traditional, see if you hear this, it would have been a more traditional argument about the Fox News people would have been saying she's big government, and you know what I mean. It would have fallen into the more traditional left right, and there would have been some sexism thrown in, and some corruption because of the classic anti Clinton trope. But my sense is it might not have been quite as. I don't think it would have been as visceral, let me put it that way. And I think the country, I think that, you know, 55 to 60% of the country, no more than that, because basically 35 to 40% of the country is always going to think something. That was Joe McCarthy, one of my favorite details, and you would appreciate this in particular, the senator from Wisconsin. Joe McCarthy's approval rating after the Army-McCarthy hearings was 34%.
Interesting.
So there's always going to be that. So you're really talking about a 10, 15, 20% part of the country that will either decide to hope or decide to fear in a given era. And in 1968, for instance, they went with Nixon. They went with a darker understanding. In 1980, they went, I think, with a brighter understanding with President Reagan.
Yes.
In 92, they went with a brighter understanding with Clinton. In 08, they went and made history
right, with
Barack Obama.
So do you think that the election of Donald Trump actually might turn out to be a good thing? It's a catalyst for us to have these conversations and to look back at history and where and how we've come out of this?
Reminds me of the old story Reagan used to tell about the little boy who went down on Christmas morning and the living room was full of manure and he jumped in and his father said, "What are you doing?" And the kid said, "I know there's a pony in here somewhere." So maybe that is the pony. I do think it's an enormous social siren air raid warning for citizenship again. One of my fundamental beliefs is that politicians are far more often mirrors of who we are than they are molders of who we are. And when people complain about the Congress and they say, oh, you know, they're all quislings for Trump, that's because they're looking at Mark Sanford down in South Carolina. They're looking in my state, in Tennessee. I think Trump has something like an 82% approval rating among Republicans. What you have to get to work doing is you have to make these folks realize that actually 55 to 60% of their district or of their state wants you to be Margaret Chase Smith, wants you to stand up to Joe McCarthy. They don't want you to just salute Trump and fall into line. And so it means everybody has got to suck it up and get out there and fight. And I know it's just dispiriting and it's hard and, it's exhausting because the wear and tear of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, America's not for the faint of heart.
That's a great quote. We are talking to John Meacham, who wrote The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. We are also taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. Joe from Milwaukee joins us. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing? What's your question?
Well, I'm actually the descendant of, Catholic immigrants,
huh?
But I think that the was professor, whoever, has a pretty sunshine and rainbows look at the immigration from the late 1800s to early 1900s, because many of them, when they came here, they did depress wages of people that were already here. They did, for example, like the Sicilian immigrants have a big problem with organized crime. For Italian, Irish immigrants, there was a big problem with corruption, Carnegie Hall, and where they take over cities and they just be totally corrupt. And so I actually did read a study recently, I'm trying to remember the name of it, where it actually demonstrated that these waves of European immigrants coming in at this time did depress wages of American citizens, and it actually displaced a lot of them, so they had to like move other places. And so I think that a country should have an immigration policy based on what's good for the citizens who are already here rather than what's good for foreigners or what's good for, say, like the rich people who control the capital. I think a lot of what he's looking at is simply a retconning of what actually happened in the history. Like I said, I'm from Catholic immigrants. My you know, ancestors were Catholic immigrants, but I can be objective enough to say that letting them all in created problems for American citizens.
Joe, thank you for that. John Meacham, Joe mentioned Tammany Hall and La Casa Nostra. Were those things that immigrants brought with them, or were they reactions to what they found here once they came to the U.S.?
I think probably a little bit of both. And I will say, before I cast stones at immigrants, my family came on the Mayflower, and yet we managed to enslave an entire people.
Yes.
So I'm not gonna throw the first tiny rock at any group. But I agree with a sentence toward the end there, which was that there has to be a sound immigration policy, of course, and mm-hmm. it has to be for what's good for the republic. Absolutely, we're not the Salvation Army as a nation state. That's not our job. But I don't think, and in fact, in 1924, Calvin Coolidge signed one of the series of restrictive immigration acts that helped take some of the energy out of the Klan. There were very restrictive quotas. It was part of what actually made it very difficult for us to open our borders for Jewish immigrants fleeing Hitler. So we have a history of a fairly open policy. We have a history of a restrictive policy. And we can sit down and look at those eras and figure out what's best. There is available data on this. And I actually think George W. Bush came as close as anybody. God, it's been, 11, 12 years now. Amazing, isn't it? To striking the kind of deal that might have made this more sensible. But I also think, and I'm 98% sure I'm right about what I'm about to say. When we talk about immigrants, we're not really talking about immigrants. We're talking about an anxiety about who we are and whether we, those of us who are here, who are citizens, feel comfortable with our future. And immigrants become convenient targets. They become the other at which we point when we're unhappy about our own prospects and our own situation.
Just like Jews were convenient targets for Hitler in World War II. We are talking with John Meacham, author of The Soul of America. We're taking a look at our current political divide through the lens of history. We'll be back in a moment with more from John and taking your calls. It's the Ideas Network. Our guest, John Meacham, here on The Morning Show, can probably talk about profiting and power. Also, he wrote The Soul of America, the battle for our better angels. We are talking to John about history and how history seems to be repeating itself, and we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So we left off just a minute ago talking about World War II, John. I want to get to the Civil War because you have said that we are still kind of dealing with the aftermath of the Civil War, which was 150 years ago.
Yep. Oh, Appomattox was as much a beginning as an end. And I think if you look at the history of race relations in the country, if you look at the perennial debate over national authority versus state autonomy, you see that the fundamental questions that led to the war and which we thought were adjudicated by the war continue to unfold. And, one of the reasons I wrote this book at all was the events now almost a year ago in Charlottesville in August when the President of the United States had a hard time deciding whether or not he was on the side of the Klan or not. And neo-Nazis or not. And so I don't think any reasonable person could say that the racism, the identity anxiety, the urge for power, the dislike and distrust of Washington, that those forces, all of which were in their most vivid manifestation during the Civil War, are not still with us.
In a way, the Union's defeat of the Confederacy, at least in the Confederacy's mind, was kind of more of a technicality?
Well, the lost cause is a fascinating thing.
Right.
It's basically an ideology that excused the defeat. It argued that we Southerners had not been out-generaled. We had simply been outnumbered. And which is an interesting, think about that for a second. If that becomes the explanation for defeat, it becomes a very useful trope to apply to future political situations. If it's a question of resources, if it's a question of being overwhelmed by the North, then any issue that comes up, you can say, oh, Washington is overwhelming us again. It's a pernicious and highly effective ideological construct, and it was huge. It is exactly what you would find in the vernacular of the South in the 1950s and 1960s,
and now in many ways.
Yeah, but particularly when the Supreme Court ruled in Brown, and it was they're coming again, and there's a lot of that now, as you say, and it's. And I think we have to understand it. I think if we begin to see it as part of this larger American story, we can see that, again, if we take a step back, I think that the eras we would most like to recreate, the eras we would most like to resemble, are the ones where we've opened our arms. And in 1965, I don't think there's any mistake or any coincidence that the Voting Rights Act was finally signed when our prosperity was most broadly and widely shared.
We are talking to presidential historian John Meacham. His book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels, is out now. We are also taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. I want to talk to Anne from Monona. Anne, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. excuse me. Well, I see actually one main and another problem that didn't exist 100 years ago. First is these free trade agreements beginning with NAFTA, which have caused just a wave of migration from country to country all over the world. This is a very unhealthy thing. People need to be able to get jobs that are fairly close to where they live. But second, and the reason I called especially was that our courts these days are being filled with reactionaries by reactionary presidents or the money of people who are propping up reactionary governors, for instance. And these courts are, in the case of the Supreme Court, are often considered the final arbiters of the law. And, you know, when President Clinton tried to get his nominee even a hearing in the Senate, Mitch McConnell refused. And that went on for a couple of years. The Democrats didn't do that when Trump was selected. And I think that people feel that they can't really go to the courts these days for justice because our courts are filled with partisan, often hacks, and often people who are not really qualified to be on, especially higher courts like the state Supreme Court and the Supreme Court itself.
Okay, Anne, I'm going to cut you off there because you brought up a lot of good things that I would like to get to John Meacham. Thank you very much for this. Anne brought up, John, globalization and movement, people moving. She brought up corporate power, and she brought up courts. And you mentioned just a minute ago that FDR actually tried to stack the Supreme Court. He actually tried to expand it, didn't he?
Yeah, his idea was to dilute the power of the existing justices by saying he could appoint one for everyone who was over 70. and so, you know, one of the things they're doing now, which is goes to the caller's point, which is really interesting, is, you know, these justices are being appointed at such young ages that they end up serving a biblical 40 years or something. So that's one of the things that it's one of the...
Unless you're Ruth Bader Ginsburg and you just keep living, you just keep going, right? Even though you were appointed when you were fairly old.
Yeah, no, and you know, it's a fascinating, and we saw, there are really two, we really boil it all down. There are really, I think, two central reasons the presidency matters more than anything else. One is the question of the projection of military force, including nuclear force. And the other is the power to appoint to the federal bench. And that's why elections matter so enormously. I think any Republican nominee would have appointed Justice Gorsuch. Basically Trump got him off the Federalist Society website, I think. So I don't think that's that different. And they would be appointing all the circuit judges, all the district judges. So it's simply a case. Now what Senator McConnell did will be studied forever. When he stopped Merrick Garland from becoming President Obama's appointee, as one of the great instances of strategic obstructionism in the history of the Republic. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing thing to accomplish. And you could argue for and against it all you want, but it worked. And it'll be really interesting to see what the Democrats decide to do if a similar situation ever comes up. On globalization, you know, I just don't know how you change the tide of broad economic change. I think what you have to do is adjust to it. And how do we, and this is an argument we've been having in this country really for 30 years now. And the person who really understood this really well and talked about it and still talks about it really well is Bill Clinton.
Right.
I remember when President Bush, 41, first went back to the White House after being defeated. It was in June of 1993, and Clinton was trying to sell NAFTA, a sign of bipartisanship, which is almost unthinkable now. And Clinton had asked Ford, Carter, and Bush to come back and help him sell this to Congress. And Clinton got up and gave his case for how globalization was going to be inevitable and how we had to educate and retrain and we had to be the winners in this. And President Bush got up after him and said, "Well, I've just realized again why he's living here and I'm not." It was such an articulate vision of it.
Wow.
And, you know, if it were easy, we'd have an answer. But But I think a lot of people have lost a lot of money through the years betting against American ingenuity.
And okay, so I want to go back to that, though, because one of the things that that Anne brought up that I thought was so interesting is people should be able to live near where they work. I totally agree with that. But in our history, that hasn't always been the case. In the 1930s, people did leave the Dust Bowl. People did leave and migrated to California and elsewhere. We have a country where people seek out the opportunity. What's different now?
What's different now is that the jobs themselves don't exist. People went to California because of the defense industries. People left the farms in the 19-teens and 20s because agriculture was becoming less significant, and they were moving to the big industrial cities to work there. There are any state that's hard at work on economic development. They are thrilled when they get 30 and 40 job, 50 job businesses to come in. And in my home state, in Tennessee, I think one of the large, Nissan moved from California, moved its North American headquarters to suburban Nashville, Tennessee. You had VW, obviously German company, move. It's a huge plant to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Who won the Second World War? I mean, so you have Japan in Middle Tennessee. You have Germany in East Tennessee. And why are they in a state like Tennessee? They're there because we don't have a state income tax, mm-hmm. and because the state did a good job of recruiting them. It's light manufacturing. Look at all the number. I'm sure there was Wisconsin examples. Look at all the cities that applied for that Amazon headquarters. That's a sign of where we are, and those are those like the jobs of the union jobs of the industrial belt of the post-war era? Not exactly, but we just have to keep chugging here, and it's why I think the if I were had a magic wand, I would do a GI Bill for everyone. That in exchange for higher education and for the ability to continue to be educated throughout, your working life, you give back something in national service, you'd help out. Because the GI Bill is one of the great pieces of legislation. When I'm out talking about this book, I'll say, who here was affected by the GI Bill? And it tells you something about the demographics of my audience, I guess. But lots of hands go up because it was part of the covenant. You serve, we'll help you out.
It was a part of the covenant, as you have pointed out before, for white people, not necessarily as much for people of color, but we've also run out of time and can't dive into that. We have been speaking with John Meacham, a presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize winning author. Actually, somebody told me it was Pulitzer Prize winning author. He's also contributing editor at Time, and his book is called The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. John, thank you for being with us today.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.